Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Rodriguez, and I'm appearing for petitioner Juan Barcenas, and I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. The two issues that I would like to focus on today is whether there was an abuse of discretion by the courts below in not allowing petitioner to sufficient time to properly prepare and document his motion to reopen, and the second is whether fraudulent representation by a notario is sufficient cause to reopen an absentia removal order. As to the first issue, we would argue there was an abuse of discretion when considering that petitioner was detained at the time that the motion was filed, and the attorney was limited to requesting all pertinent documents via Freedom of Information Act request, which is standard practice, and petitioner could not submit a declaration based on facts he was not aware of. If anything, the only things that he was aware of at said time was that he had a prior order of removal and that he believed an attorney that he later consulted with that there was nothing he could do about that case. Since then, there had really not been any reason for him to know that the actions by the notario or the subsequent attorney that he consulted acted ineffectively. Petitioner's attorney was held, and petitioner was held to have a full understanding of petitioner's case within a matter of just a few weeks. He filed his motion, and within less than a month, that petition was there was a decision on that motion, all while he also had a concurrent case for withholding and convention against torture with the immigration judge. The time it took to get all the necessary documents was not unreasonable, given neither the attorney nor the petitioner had control over how FOIA requests are processed. It is the government's argument, however, that petitioner not only should have been fully appraised of facts he never had a reason to doubt, but that he should also have filed a petition for review while he also had a pending withholding convention against torture claim to focus on while also being detained. Would argue that that is discretionary, and that this court could toll both the numerical limitations and also the timeliness factor. Our argument is that it would be unreasonable to expect a respondent to file a petition for review while he still has a pending case, and also would be against this court's interest because it would cause further litigation. And then just finally, we would argue that here fraudulent representation by notario was sufficient to reopen a removal order, because it is clear that petitioner asked about his initial hearing and he was specifically told by that notario not to attend. This court has reviewed similar cases and has found that that is a sufficient cause and does not require Lozada compliance. Had the notario refrained from giving that faulty advice, petitioner would have attended his hearing, and he would have had been given an opportunity to meaningfully request his relief. Also, very briefly, since I have the time, I would note we already put this on the response to respondent's motion for summary disposition, but again, we would just note that currently, in terms of jurisdiction for the initial case, the notice to appear, it did not include the immigration court address, the NTA, and that is required by both the statute and the regulation. So that is how we are distinguishing currently from this case, and we would ask for this court to remand for further review of that issue.
Counselor, didn't your client wait over 15 years to file his motion to reopen?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, essentially, but the only reason he did that is because after he found out that he he had an absentia order. He did go to another attorney. He does. My understanding is he doesn't know who that attorney was, and that's why no Lozada compliance was made as to that factor. But at that time, he was told there was nothing to be done. So until his most recent detention in 2017, when he spoke to his most recent counsel, Mr. Hiltz, there was no question of what he could do. In fact, he only wanted, he requested withholding Convention Against Torture because when he was returned to to his country in 2008, he had several things happened to him to where he wanted to claim a fear. So his intent from the beginning of when he was just recently detained wasn't even to do a motion to reopen, because there's no reason why he would believe that was even an option, because nobody ever asked him about it.
So, counsel, how are we supposed, this is Judge Wardlaw, how are we, so you have, there seems to be parallel proceedings here. You had the proceedings on the motions to reopen, and the whole Lozada thing, where apparently you didn't meet the requirements of Lozada, and then you had a separate petition for review based on the merits of his claims.
Yes. So initially, when he first retained us, he, like I said, he had claimed a fear, and he was only eligible for withholding and Convention Against Torture because he had a prior order of removal based on that in absentia order. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat the question? I think I might have missed the point of your question.
The point of my question is we're evaluating essentially two petitions for review, right?
Oh, yes.
Or are they merged into one?
I would say that they are, because what I was saying earlier, taking into consideration that when he did file the appeal for the motion to reopen and then tried to then reconsider that decision, which was actually taken as a motion to reopen because of the substance of the case, at that time he had still his pending withholding Convention Against Torture case concurrently being litigated. So I guess what we're arguing
is... My question to you, counsel, is why are you not arguing anything to do with the merits here?
The person who wrote the opening brief already discussed those specific issues. But I mean, if the court or if the panel has specific questions on that,
well, I guess my problem with the merits decision is it's technical. I think, you know, in reading that, I think the BIA didn't follow correctly all of the analysis that needs to be done under the Convention Against Torture. But you don't, I mean, have you abandoned that argument? I mean, are you not raising it?
No, we're not abandoning that issue, Your Honor. It's just, like I said, I was focusing on those two issues.
What is your argument? Let me ask you then, what is your argument on CAT?
On CAT, we would argue that the judge focused on the applicant not proving that it was impossible for him to be able to move to anywhere else in his country. In essence, that's our argument, it wasn't the applicant's burden to do that, and that the judge should have expanded more on his reasoning as to why he's not eligible for convention.
Now, counsel, go ahead.
Do you argue that the beatings that he suffered in Mexico rose to the level of torture?
We would argue that it rose to the level of torture. He was detained for, I believe it was 12 hours by police. Well, not specifically by police that he knows of, but the police actually took him under the false claim that he had stolen a purse and taken to an unknown location where he was there tortured. We would note that the beatings were not minor. Even though he didn't go to the hospital, does not mean that he didn't suffer emotional distress and mental suffering during that instance and my time is up, Your Honors, but if you have
questions. Think Judge Van Dyke has a question for you.
Yeah, so, sure. Counsel, just so I understand the relationship between your two different petitions that you're talking about merging, if we disagreed on the motion to reopen with you, if we agreed with the government, with the BIA on the motion to reopen, do we even reach any of these other merits issues, or are they independently before us? Our ability to review those, does that depend upon you prevailing on your motion to reopen?
I mean, I think there would still be merit in him being able to revisit the issues with Convention Against Torture. However, if the court did agree with petitioner, then he would be able to seek other forms of relief. Though what I could think of right now is possibly voluntary departure, which is not a minimal type of.
Counsel, you have two appeals. You have appeal number 1772624 and appeal number 1870164.
Yes, I understand. But I believe that those are consolidated.
They are consolidated. That's not the same thing as merged.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, well,
I think what your argument is that the CAT claim doesn't necessarily require you have to be reopened, but you have other claims that if you could get it reopened, you would be able to bring.
Yes, yes.
That claim is not dependent upon you being able to reopen.
No, no.
Okay. Thank you. We will hear from the government now. Mr. Stanton?
Well, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bo Stanton. I'm an attorney at the Justice Department here on behalf of William Barr. And there are two overarching issues in this case. One is the one that's been talked about in some detail, whether or not the board abused its discretion in denying petitioners untimely number barred motion to reopen based on ineffective assistance of counsel. And just to answer your question about whether or not these petitions for review merge, whether or not the motion to reopen merges with the withholding only proceedings, it does not. These are two separate petitions for review that are reviewed independently of one another. And in this case, the petitioner didn't dispute that he had an untimely motion, a number barred motion. He also didn't dispute that even if the board found that the motion was timely and equitably tolled, all the way back to when he first discovered the error in 2001, the motion would still be untimely. Doesn't dispute this. And he also doesn't dispute that there is no due process violation here because the alleged error occurred outside the proceedings. Petitioner's counsel argues that there's cases that say if a notario ends up committing a mistake, then that's ineffective assistance to counsel, but doesn't give any cases because that's not the case in this circuit. If you look at the circuit's case in Laura Torres v. Ashcroft, 404F.3D1105, the court made clear there that the unfairness of the action had to occur while proceedings were going on after a charging document was filed. In this case, petitioner filed an affirmative asylum application in 2000, and you can find this in the record, second record, page 41. Then the notion to appear, the charging document, was filed after that in February of 2001, and you can find that in the first record, page 128. And so any alleged error had no bearing on the outcome of the removal proceedings themselves. So there is no due process violation. And the final ground that they don't challenge is the fact that no effort was undertaken to comply with the matter of Lozada requirements. And the board in its decision even acknowledged that these requirements need not be rigidly enforced. But in this case, the petitioner made no effort whatsoever to demonstrate what other actions were taken to try to comply with Lozada requirements or whether or not the error was plain from the face of the record during their removal proceedings. And the board even acknowledged that from this record, the petitioner claims that the second attorney and the first attorney committed these sort of errors, but there was never an attorney entered in those removal proceedings. So when you step back and look at the motion to reopen based on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, there was no ground upon which the board could find to grant it. And so we would argue that the court should not disturb the denial of this motion to reopen. Well, the second issue in this case is whether or not substantial evidence supports the board's conclusion that petitioner did not establish eligibility for withholding or removal or protection under the Convention Against Torture. And I know, Ms. Wardlaw, that you had some questions, perhaps, about the Convention Against Torture. I'd be happy to take any questions on that before I jump into the meat, if you have any, that is.
Yeah, I do have a question about the analysis. where in the BIA's analysis, where in the BIA's analysis of Barcena's CAT claim does it mention the country conditions evidence in the record?
The Board of Immigration Appeals didn't specifically reference that documentary evidence in reviewing that decision, but the immigration judge did talk about the evidence as a whole.
Right. And the BIA did not incorporate the IJ's discussion of the country conditions report.
I respectfully disagree. If you look at the board's decision, it says that it finds no clear error in the predictive findings of the immigration judge regarding the likelihood that he will face torture by or with the consent or acquiescence, including willful blindness, of any public official or person acting in an official capacity, and cites the immigration judge's decision.
Right, but we have, sitting on bonk, we have held that even where the BIA agrees with the IJ's decision, that does not mean that it adopted it or incorporated it. And I don't see any mention of the country conditions by the BIA.
Well, the lack of this mention isn't fatal to the board's decision, because you look at the decision as a whole, you can tell that it actually considered the record.
Actually, we do have several cases that say the BIA, it could have adopted and incorporated the IJ's decision, but it didn't. We have several cases that have remanded when the BIA does not expressly discuss all the evidence in the record on a CAT claim. I'm sorry, after 4 days of doing this, I'm losing my voice. But did you get my question?
Yes, Your Honor. And I see what you're saying in terms of having case law out there, but I've also seen case law, too, that says where the Board of Immigration Appeals doesn't mention every piece of evidence, but it's clear from the decision itself that it did consider the record as a whole in rendering that decision. It was thoughtful. It cited to the record. It cited the law. It just wasn't a boilerplate decision. That's sufficient to conclude that the board did consider the record in its entirety.
Counsel, do you have a Ninth Circuit case you can refer me to?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I would be happy to file something after this argument, bringing those cases to your attention.
That would be helpful. Also, the only other concern I have with the CAT analysis is that the BIA stated that Barcenas did not carry his burden of showing that internal relocation to Tijuana was unreasonable. But you know, right, that it's not the petitioner's burden to show that internal relocation, that he could not relocate. It's the government's burden to show that he could relocate, right?
I believe that in terms of whose burden it is for the CAT protection, just give me one moment, Your Honor, because I did brief this issue in the government's brief, and I relied on some law.
Let me help you. It is the petitioner's burden to show eligibility for CAT. I agree with you that it's the petitioner's burden always to show that they're eligible for relief. But once they've shown that, it's the government's burden to show they could relocate, not the petitioner's burden. And the only reason it bothers me is I feel like, I know this sounds technical, and I I'm not sure that Barsanis could ever prevail, but it concerns me when over time I see that BIA's decision sort of slipping away from the well-established law regarding how this analysis is supposed to go.
I definitely appreciate that.
Can I jump in here? This is Judge Van Dyke. I can ask a couple questions. I just want to be sure I'm clear about your answers to Judge Wardlaw's questions. Counsel, first of all, I think I understood your position that your position, the government's position, is that the BIA did, in fact, incorporate the IJ's decision here. You cited to the language that said it agreed and then cited to the IJ's decision. So is it your position that the BIA did incorporate the IJ's position and specifically with regard to the country conditions?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. We make that argument in our brief as well.
Okay. So that I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. That's your decision. And secondly, is it your position, that the BIA has to mention the country conditions in its order, or can the BIA rely on IJ's analysis to mention the country conditions?
I believe it's twofold. One is that it can rely on the immigration judge's decision and findings. And in this case, I think it was pretty explicit that they did so. But also, even ignoring, let's just say they didn't even incorporate the immigration judge's decision, you can tell from the body of the whole decision itself that they did consider the record. While they may not have mentioned it specifically.
Counsel, we're running out of time. I thought that was your position. I just wanted to make sure. And then one other thing I just want to make sure on Judge Wardlaw's other questions. On the Maldonado issue of the relocation issue, I think Judge Wardlaw had said that the BIA had said that it was the petitioner's burden to prove that the internal relocation was not reasonable. But I don't think that the BIA's decision, I'm reading it here, it says, I read the BIA's decision as saying that the immigration judge did not require them to prove that it was impossible. What is your position on what the BIA, I think the case that Judge Wardlaw, not to put words in her mouth, but I think she's referring to the Maldonado case, which was the en banc decision by this court about this whole relocation thing. How do you read that case as far as who's got the burden and what do they have to show? Impossibility, reasonableness? What's your position on that?
So and we do actually cite that same case of the Maldonado decision in our brief in answering this argument, because at no point did the board deny him, cat protection solely because re-internal location was impossible. Those words were never even used. If you step back and look, they did what they were supposed to do under the regulations. They're supposed to look at any relevant factors that bear on the likelihood of future torture in the country the petitioner is going to return to. And so the government's position is that the relocation finding is one part of the much larger CAT finding, because the board also, and the immigration judge also, found that there was no past torture. And I know petitioner's counsel says, that there was all this mental anguish and distraughtness. Well, petitioner himself testified that the harm he experienced wasn't very severe. And so, even from his own words, he didn't experience harm that rises to the level of past torture. But even if, yes, Your Honor.
Excuse me. I understand what you're saying, but I think what Judge Van Dyke and I were both focused on is the language that where the BIA says, we agree with the immigration judge that the applicant did not carry his burden of establishing that it would be unreasonable for him to internally relocate. And it's, I guess, my point, and maybe Judge Van Dyke is asking you it another way, is whether it's the applicant's burden to establish that it would be unreasonable for him, or whether it's the government's burden under Maldonado. And I understand.
What is your position on that? That would be helpful to know, Counsel.
Your Honor, I I would prefer to read that case again before I go out on a limb and tell you exactly what it says. I know that's not very helpful. Again, I could write a letter and expound upon that a little more, but I just don't want to, go out there without really knowing for sure. I want to be sure when I answer you.
Yes, I appreciate that, counsel. And if you want to do a short letter follow up letter brief on the two points we mentioned, we would welcome that. So I appreciate that. And you're over your time. I think we helped you get there, but I'm going to stop you right now. And I think I have to give petitioner 1 minute. So if you want to just briefly sum up, and then I will give petitioner 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. For all the reasons that we lay out in our brief, we believe both petitions for review should be denied. The board didn't abuse its discretion in denying the motion based on ineffective assistance of counsel, and substantial evidence does support the denial of withholding of removal and protection under the Convention Against Torture. And we would ask the court to deny both those petitions.
Well, thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Rodriguez, you have a minute.
Yes, Your Honor. I would just briefly note that in Maldonado, and we did brief this in the opening brief on page 32, it states that neither Section 1208.16c2 requires the applicant for a deferral or removal to prove that internal relocation is impossible. That's on page 1163, so that's our position on that. Also, I would briefly note
Counsel, can I ask you about that? I mean, yeah, you're right. That's what Maldonado says. It says you can't put the burden on the petitioner to show that it was impossible. But as I read the BIA's decision, I mean, the BIA actually specifically addresses that in its decision and says that although the applicant argues the immigration judge held him to prove internal relocation was impossible, and then it goes on to basically reach the conclusion that the immigration judge didn't hold them to that burden to show that it was impossible. So it seems like the BIA addressed that and rejected that reading of the BIA, of the IJ's decision.
Well, Your Honor, I would also note that in that same decision, in the last paragraph, it does specifically states in its decision that the applicant did not carry his burden of establishing that it would be unreasonable for him to
unreasonable as opposed to impossible. So it kind of turns on what does Maldonado say that they don't have the burden to show that it's unreasonable. I'm not sure Maldonado says that. In fact, it says the ultimate burden remains on the applicant. I don't know what that means. If the applicant has some burden, I think, under Maldonado.
Yes, but that wasn't addressed, I don't believe, in the BIA decision, neither in the IJ decision. In the IJ decision, I think the wording is impossible. I can't point to it, unfortunately, but from my recollection, I think that's the wording that the immigration judge uses, that he didn't prove that it was impossible for him.
I don't think that's right, counsel, but I just did a word search on the BIA decision just to make sure I was, but I don't think it says that. And I'm sorry, in the IJ decision, I don't think the IJ used the word impossible.
All right. Well, you're over your time in any event, Ms. Rodriguez. So thank you very much. And we will submit Barcenas versus Barr and take up Lee versus Barr.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.